Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 26th, 2021 Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy. Today I'll be reading the following main articles. Tents off limits in parts of Denver by Joe Rubino of the Denver Post. Doctors who trained overseas face red tape by Saja Hindi of the Denver Post. And the car key of the future still will be in your pocket by Stephen Williams of the New York Times Company. And I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Our first story, homelessness. Tents off limits in parts of Denver. City balances Five Points cleanup zone with new safe outdoor space in Clayton next month by Joe Rubino. The city of Denver has quietly increased its efforts to prevent encampments of homeless people from forming in one downtown neighborhood, while also working to provide city land for a sanctioned camping site a few miles away. City crews are clearing unhoused people and their belongings from sidewalks and other public rights of way at least three times a week in an approximately 10-block area in the Five Points neighborhood, officials said. Permanent regular cleanups are needed in this area to consistently promote the health and safety of everyone in the area, including those experiencing homelessness. Nancy Kuhn, spokeswoman for the city's Department of Transportation and Infrastructure, said in an emailed statement. The area identified by officials in late September is bounded by Broadway, Park Avenue, Welton, and 20th Streets. It's dotted with signs that mark it a permanent zone for what opponents to the camping ban refer to as sweeps. The permanent cleanup zone was first reported by Westward. Kuhn said the cleanup actions make the sidewalk accessible so people don't have to walk in the street and help to mitigate public health risks created by trash, decomposing food, discarded needles, human waste, and flammable materials such as propane and gasoline. Unlike in most encampment cleanups, the city does not provide notice to people camping in the area 7 days in advance. The notice rule was established by a federal injunction this year. It's an attempted end run around the requirements of the preliminary injunction. Andy McNulty, the attorney who filed the federal lawsuit against the city's camping ban, said this week, "They are putting up a zone that essentially says you can't exist here if you're an unhoused person." McNulty and Assistant City Attorney Connor Farley delivered arguments in a hearing with a panel of judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit last week about the merits of the preliminary injunction. The city's goal was to have the restrictions on its camping ban enforcement powers lifted. Farley noted in his comments there is a process through which the city can speed up enforcement actions to a 48-hour timetable if an emergency public health risk exists in an encampment. Farley said that it's still not soon enough. He also acknowledged the public record is thin on examples of public health emergencies that require a speedier response. A representative for the city attorney's office declined to comment on the arguments, which are still being considered by the judges on the panel. McNulty said the hearing was a demonstration that the city has been disingenuous about its motives for cleaning encampments. They just want the power to do whatever they want, whenever they want, with no consequences, and they are not happy that someone is actually holding them accountable for once, he said. The permanent cleanup area the city marked out in September is the second of its kind, Kuhn said. Another area approximately outlined by Larimer, Arapaho, 22nd and 24th Streets is also subject to regular enforcement, she said. In her emailed statement, Kuhn encouraged people who are homeless to embrace the city services available to them rather than stay on the streets. Our shelters have capacity. They are open 24/7. Many do not require sobriety. They are safe and clean and provide essential services to exit homelessness, including case management and rehousing, she said. Kuhn emailed the Denver Post her statement before a Denver Rescue Mission employee was fatally stabbed at the organization's shelter for men at 4600 East 48th Avenue Saturday night. The potential for violent episodes is just one thing that can keep unhoused people from using the city's shelter network. Kathy Alderman, Chief Public Policy Officer for the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, noted that sleeping in a large open room with other people is not ideal for everyone, and the environment can be triggering for people struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder. The coalition has offices in the permanent cleanup area in Five Points. The enforcement doesn't necessarily mean there are fewer people on the street, but that those people who otherwise would have been near the coalition offices and the offices of other service providers in the area are now more spread out. We don't support the enforcement of the camping ban. We think it's wildly unproductive, Alderman said. But at the same time, encampments do sometimes bring safety issues with them. The city's crackdown on camping in that corner of Five Points comes at a time when officials are shepherding through approval a sanctioned homeless camping site, known as a safe outdoor space, on the East Denver campus of the city's Department of Human Services. The site at 3815 Steele Street in the Clayton neighborhood will be the first safe outdoor space on a city-owned property when it opens next month, pending final City Council approval. The site will replace another space on the campus of a Park Hill church that is set to close at the end of the year. The Clayton space will have 41 tents equipped with electricity and capable of hosting up to 50 people, according to the Colorado Village Collaborative, the nonprofit the city has contracted to operate the sites. The city will lease the land to the collaborative for $10 for the first year, with 2 6-month extension options. I am excited to see the city stepping up in that way and making public land available for that purpose, Cole Chandler, Colorado Village Collaborative's executive director, said this week. We think that's indicative of really the public conversation around these sites shifting. The nonprofit was awarded an $899,000 contract to operate the improved camping sites this year, and as of last week had served more than 120 households that were previously unsheltered and living on the streets, Chandler said. Next week, it plans to open a site near Denver Health Medical Center. By the end of the year, assuming the site on the Human Services campus is approved, the nonprofit will have 3 sites, with aims to open a 4th in early 2022. The city and the nonprofit are negotiating a contract for next year. In a committee hearing about the Clayton site last week, City Councilman Chris Hines noted that his District 10 hosted the first 2 temporary safe outdoor spaces this year, and neighbors went from sending him emails opposing them to embracing them as a safer alternative to encampments. This is a transformative model, he said. It has had an incredible amount of success. November's election results also give Chandler hope, he said. Not only did voters reject initiated Ordinance 303, which would have made the camping ban more strict, they also supported preserving the group living amendment, intended to keep housing costs down in the city. Denver's Department of Housing Stability recently earned council approval for its 5-year strategic plan and projects having more than $270.6 million to spend next year, including $40.9 million from the Homelessness Resolution Fund that voters approved in 2020. Almost 50% of that budget is earmarked for homelessness resolution efforts. Alderman said that providing more safe outdoor spaces is a positive step, providing an alternative between camping ban enforcement and shelters. But like the existing shelter system, those are only short-term solutions. The city is making investments in housing and homeless at a scale that it never has before. And that is a good thing, Alderman said. Unfortunately, we are in a pretty big crisis, so it's going to take a while for those dollars to have the intended impact. Our next story, groups trying to help them practice in Colorado. Doctors who trained overseas face red tape, by Saja Hindi. 3 years ago, after multiple visits to emergency rooms and her OBGYN office, a patient who was dealing with severe pain and no diagnosis sought out Wafa Alejmi for advice. Alejmi, who was working as a clinical researcher in Denver, was not a practicing doctor in Colorado, but had OBGYN residency experience after graduating from medical school in Libya. Someone the patient knew had recommended she reach out to Alejmi when she was at her wit's end. After 10 minutes of listening to the patient talk about her symptoms, vaginal bleeding and hemorrhagic cysts in her pelvis, pain and insomnia, Alejmi gave her an opinion. The patient had an incomplete bilateral oophorectomy. Basically, she still had ovarian tissue in her body, despite having had her ovaries removed at least a year earlier. And it was causing problems with the hormonal replacement therapy she was taking. It took advocacy by the patient and three more doctors looking at her ultrasound before they confirmed what Alejmi had told her. We are trained to use our knowledge and skills more than rely on machines, Alejmi said. That is a strength we can add to this healthcare system, is accurate diagnosis. Then machines can confirm our diagnosis and not vice versa. Although Alejmi was born in Greeley, she spent most of her life in Libya, minus a few years in Britain. So that's where she did her medical schooling, before moving back to Colorado in November 2007. She wasn't prepared for the hurdles she would face as an international medical graduate trying to practice medicine in the state. The process is not only lengthy and costly, it requires these graduates from approved schools to complete 3 years of postgraduate clinical training in the state to get licensed to practice, competing for limited residency spots. U.S. graduates have to complete only 1 year. This year, Colorado Democratic lawmakers asked the Nurse Physician Advisory Task Force for Colorado Healthcare within the Colorado Department of Regulatory Agencies to make recommendations for how to make the process easier for the estimated 2,000 Coloradans who earned medical degrees and were licensed in other countries so they could join Colorado's workforce of physicians. The group released a list of three main recommendations, including six proposals that would require legislative action or approval by the Colorado Medical Board. Those recommendations include allowing physicians who had an active medical license in another country to qualify for a Colorado license by successfully completing a competency assessment, allowing international medical graduates who have not qualified for an active license in another country to apply for internships to practice in a clinical setting and match for residency, and increasing the residency slots and earmarking spots for qualified international medical graduates. NPATCH's recommendations regarding the licensure pathways available to international medical graduates, or IMGs, could position Colorado to benefit from underutilized medical expertise in our communities, said Lee Reziser, a spokesperson for the Colorado Department of Regulatory Agencies, in an email. In the longer term, successful implementation could attract medical expertise from a wider range and potentially help to mitigate health care shortages. In April of last year, Governor Jared Polis signed an executive order that temporarily changed some licensing requirements for medical professionals, including for international medical graduates who could become eligible for temporary licenses under certain conditions through May 31, 2022. This was independent of the NPATCH recommendations and was meant to help with the high demand for medical professionals with rising COVID-19 case counts. But only two international medical graduates were able to get their temporary licenses, and only one practices with it, according to Carrie Miller, program manager for the Spring Institute's Colorado Welcome Back program. The organization helps internationally trained healthcare professionals establish careers in the healthcare industry in Colorado. Problems came up involving malpractice insurance, but it also became clear too many barriers to entry still existed for those who earned medical degrees outside the United States. Those barriers often include time and cost. Many professionals end up having to take other jobs to support their families more quickly, and residency programs in the state don't accept anyone who graduated more than 3 years prior, said Victoria Francis, state advocacy officer for the International Rescue Committee. Even if you were a surgeon running a hospital in another country, you come to Colorado and you don't have the opportunity to go back to a medical residency unless you move out of the state. So there's just a whole host of reasons why it's really hard for these individuals to put their skills to work in Colorado, Francis said. Lawahis Abbas, an international medical graduate from Sudan, who moved to Colorado in 2012 to join her family after seeking asylum, knew she would have to start from the beginning to pursue a medical career. But first, she needed time to adjust to her new country, learn the language, the culture, and its systems. When she was ready to join the physician ranks, she kept bumping into obstacles. She decided to pursue other pathways while working toward her license. She has worked as a medical interpreter and with refugee programs at healthcare centers. She has been studying for a master's degree in public health. I'm not going to stop trying, Abbas said. I hope they can do something to make it easier, because there are so many international medical graduates in Colorado. They are really qualified and really trained. Miller was part of the advisory panel helping provide information for the NPATCH recommendations, and she said during her research she found that in the past decade in Colorado, only 2.5% of all residency slots were given to international medical graduates. Alegmi is one of those graduates. After moving back to the U.S., she studied again, passed the first required exam, and did medical rotations with physicians. She said she was treated like a colleague because of the amount of experience and knowledge that she brought with her. Still, despite the recommendations she received and how many applications she put in, she could not get matched for a residency program. Now, Alegmi works as a clinical researcher for the Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers in Aurora and serves as a consultant for the Colorado Welcome Back program to share her experiences. I didn't have a plan B, she said. I needed to fulfill that passion. State Representative Nikita Ricks, a Democrat from Aurora, plans to introduce legislation next year that would implement some of NPATCH's recommendations, including finding a way to help international medical graduates get into residency programs in the state. She also wants to look at some type of reciprocity for people who have practiced medicine in other countries to find pathways to practice in Colorado, potentially modeling a program after what states such as Minnesota are doing. Part of the bill that's being drafted may include requirements for these graduates to work in areas of the state that are underserved. Considering the shortage of the medical workforce right now, including doctors, nurses, CNAs, we need to ensure that people who come here with medical degrees have an opportunity to work in our society to do what they've been trained to do, Rick said. Alegmi is advocating for these changes as she continues to apply and keep up with her medical skills, remaining undeterred. I do what I do because I'm passionate about helping people, and what better way than to help people stay healthy, to continue their journey in life, to fulfill their purpose, she said. I have so much to give. The Car Key of the Future Still Will Be in Your Pocket by Stephen Williams. Call them what you want. Digital keys the shape of a credit card, keyless start pods, keyless push-button start devices, intelligent keys, or smart or smartphone keys. They're the way we open and start cars now, and more. And it's unlikely the primitive keys of the past are coming back. At an upstate New York gathering of the International Motor Press Association before the pandemic, journalists spent a day tooling along roads near Bear Mountain in lots of new cars. Alfa Romeo, BMW, Volvo, Volkswagen, Lexus, Acura. Not once did they touch an ignition key. Certainly the shift from cranks and solenoids and bits of small metal to remote wireless contraptions isn't only about science and technology. There are elements of convenience, design, ecology, and fashion, but mostly it's about science and technology. Sometimes, however, one might wish for a real key. The alternatives are not bulletproof. Tesla drivers recently punched up the smartphone app they used to unlock and start their cars. The app was not responding, as the server had gone down. The Tesla key card would work, Tesla's version of a fob, but drivers who depended on their phones were stuck. The problem was sorted out fairly quickly, and Elon Musk, the company's CEO, tweeted apologies. It was Chrysler in 1949 that introduced the key that operated the combined ignition and starter switch, said Brandt Rosenbusch, manager of historical services for the former Fiat Chrysler automobiles, now called Stellantis. Prior to this, he added, cars were started by turning a key to power the ignition, and drivers then pushed a starter button, either on the floor or instrument panel. Before the 1960s, most vehicles required a separate coded key to switch on the ignition and one to open the doors or trunk. For decades, teens regularly have asked Dad, "Can I have the keys?" That means just one thing. Can I take the car? Be careful, he would say. Do teenagers today ask Dad, "Can I have the fob?" It took decades for the fob, believed to be related to the German word Fupe, meaning pocket, to acquire remote capabilities and send coded radio signals to a receiver in the vehicle. Often the first fob function was allowing drivers to lock and unlock the doors. Advancements in technology granted it the ability to open the trunk, activate an alarm system, and eventually develop smarts. Simply carry it into the cockpit and push the start button on or near the dash. The new technologies also helped to foil the best efforts of the Gone in 60 Seconds bandits. Some 20th century keys developed personalities. Volkswagen favored the switchblade key, which slid out of the fob like a shiv. Some ignition keys that were coded were usable only in a particular car. In Volvo's new electric XC40 recharge SUV, the start function is in the driver's seat, with the fob in a pocket. A driver need only place a backside on the cushion and the motor starts. When the driver lifts off the cushion, the engine stops. Years ago, the engineers for the Porsches that raced at Le Mans determined that locating the ignition to the left of the steering wheel saved time on the race start. Drivers of other cars had to use their right hands to first start the engine and then to engage the first gear. At Porsche, the left hand turned the key, and the right engaged the gear shift simultaneously. Most of today's Porsches place the ignition switch on the left. Several vehicle operating functions have been outsourced to smartphones. For example, an app for some BMWs can start the auto remotely. It will run for 15 minutes, heating or cooling the cabin, before automatically shutting off. But some type of hardware, a wireless fob, round or square, with tiny buttons to open and close doors, hatches, windows, and sunroofs, and perhaps a panic function to set off the car's alarm system, will most likely remain until mobile devices eliminate the need for a physical piece of hardware altogether, said Todd Parker, director of global design for General Motors. The march of key fob progress is assuredly unstoppable, and the ultimate recipient, the car buyer, is in its crosshairs. At the Volvo of Queens dealership in New York, Peter Furon, a salesman, said the migration from metal key to electric controller was a fait accompli. "Everything in the car is computer controlled," he said. "Everybody's happy." "Not everybody," said John Albanese, who works at Bayside Volkswagen next door to Volvo. "Usually older people, they don't like the push button to start the car," he said. "They're afraid they'll forget to shut off the car. They think it'll somehow fail. A young person just wants to talk to the car. Start the car, drive me home. It's a totally different mindset." Albanese, who's been selling automobiles of assorted brands for 43 years, also suggests that modern fob devices complicate the delivery process. "We explain the functions, but half the time what we tell customers goes in one ear and out the other, he said. And the owner's manual, well, that's never touched, never opened. There's also the question of replacing a lost modern fob. Figure more than $200, Albanese warns, and then each key has to be programmed because each car is different. Parker believes the modern key is enabling us to completely redefine the vehicle ownership experience. Car keys, no matter what form they take, will create a seamless bridge between an individual driver's unique preferences and the vehicle itself, he said. Our vehicles will automatically adjust settings like cabin temperature, lighting, music, and seat positioning prior to even opening the door. The evolution of car key technology will continue to expand the range and capabilities of these distinct experiences. Switching back to more local news, 17-year-old dead after shooting. A 17-year-old is dead after a shooting Wednesday night in Aurora involving a former Greenwood Village police officer, police confirmed. Aurora police said they were notified about two males shooting each other in the 4900 block of South Addison Way about 10:30 p.m. Wednesday. Both were taken to a hospital. The 17-year-old died from his wounds. The other, a 36-year-old former police officer, is expected to survive, Aurora police said. Police did not name either. Police believe the shooting started as an argument between the adult and a group of teenagers after alleged careless driving throughout the neighborhood. At some point during the argument, the adult and the teenager pulled out guns and fired shots. Detectives are working to figure out who the primary aggressor was and what circumstances led to the shooting, police said. No arrests had been made as of Thursday afternoon. Police said the 36-year-old is not employed by any law enforcement agency. That was by Elizabeth Hernandez of the Denver Post. Missing girl found in Utah. A 13-year-old Aurora girl who was believed to have been abducted or enticed from her home was found in Utah hours later. An Amber Alert was issued later for the Vail area as the girl was believed to be traveling with Navarro Cathy, 41, in a Ford Crown Victoria. The Utah Department of Public Safety reported that Cathy was apprehended just outside of Green River at 3:34 p.m. A Utah Highway Patrol sergeant located the vehicle traveling west on I-70, and when he got behind the vehicle, it initially sped up to nearly 100 miles per hour, the Utah Department of Public Safety reported. As they got near the other officers and initiated a traffic stop, the subject pulled right over and he was taken into custody without incident, the Utah Department of Public Safety reported. Troopers found the victim safe inside the vehicle. Charges are pending for Cathy, according to the Aurora Police Department. And that was from the Vail Daily and Denver 7. Proposed bill would offer sex workers safe reporting by Alex Burness of the Denver Post. Legislative and law enforcement officials have heard sex workers say over and over that they feel unsafe reporting crimes to police because they fear they won't be listened to, or worse, they might be prosecuted for their own illegal activity. In response, one Colorado lawmaker, Arvada Democratic State Representative Brianna Titone, said she intends to bring a safe reporting bill in the upcoming legislative session beginning in January. Details are still being workshopped, but the basic idea is to create a guarantee that illegal sex workers can report crimes without fear of any legal retribution. It's not unlike a 2012 law that Colorado adopted to guarantee immunity for illegal drug users who report overdoses. A likely point of debate is where lawmakers would draw the line on immunity. It can be done, but you have to define carefully what crimes the bill would cover, said Boulder District Attorney Michael Doherty, a proponent of safe reporting. It's fairly easy to say someone engaged in sex work who is beaten during the act should not be prosecuted for the sex work. I'd like to believe most people would fully support that. But if the person engaged in the sex work is committing some other worse offense, is that covered? Sex workers this year detailed in a a Denver Post report the various ways that the criminalization of their work and the stigma that comes with legal stripping and online content creation and illegal prostitution, sex work, leave them vulnerable to physical and economic harms as well as societal isolation. Desiree Collins, a former sex worker closely involved in advocacy work in Colorado, said she is skeptical that safe reporting alone will do much to help this community. She's also skeptical that sex workers would take advantage of it. It's probably going to not make that big of a difference, especially if there's no way to maintain anonymity in reporting, she said. You're talking about a community where part of the culture is distrust, because distrust keeps you safe. Some in law enforcement said they already abide by safe reporting standards. Doherty said a new bill would not change his outlook, and Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin told the Denver Post last week that he can promise illegal sex workers support if they come forward to report having been victims of crimes such as assault and robbery. But Doherty understands sex workers are hesitant to trust in any representatives of a legal system. He recalled an instance in which a woman in his district was sexually assaulted in the dead of night while on the job as a prostitute. When the police came, she insisted she was a legal secretary at a law firm, which was not true, just because she was worried she wouldn't be taken seriously, he said. Most sex work advocacy in Colorado is centered on the goal of decriminalization. That would be the ultimate guarantee, they say, of security in reporting crimes and speaking up for themselves. Anything short of that, including safe reporting laws, preserves close to all of the existing danger that comes with the work. Sex workers argue their community can be kept safe while staying tough on sex trafficking and human trafficking. The notion that anyone involved in illegal sex work is exploited and would rather do something else is false but pervasive. It's not like we're asking a whole lot, Collins said. We're not asking for people who are abusive to go unpunished, for people who are exploiting people to go unpunished. In fact, we feel decriminalization would help those efforts. The decriminalization conversation is taking place now in New York, but it's not one that government leaders in many other states seem eager for. That's clearly true in Colorado, where Attorney General Phil Wieser told the Post last month through a spokesman that he has not examined the idea of decriminalization and thus had no opinion to offer. In an interview on November 18th, Governor Jared Polis would not say whether he supports or opposes decriminalization. Thanksgiving. Inject some good into the world. Denver Chef volunteers. Make sure those in need have warm holiday meal. By Elizabeth Hernandez. Denver Chef Tazaji Hook was busy cooking, packing, and distributing thousands of charitable Thanksgiving meals Thursday morning. But when he saw a young man in need outside one of his headquarters, he paused to take the person a plate of hot food. Cooks set up shop at Denver Food Hall's Zeppelin Station and Avanti Food and Beverage, with a rotating cast of volunteers who started cooking Wednesday night and had not stopped Thursday morning. Cook took a time out with the man in need, who sat outside Zeppelin Station on Thanksgiving morning, wrapped in a blanket and without shoes, to talk to him and give him a warm meal. This was the generous spirit Cook and his team were all about. I just want to inject some good into the world, Cook said. Cook, wife Danielle, and a crew of more than 100 volunteers were hard at work for the chef's third annual Miss Betty's Harvest Madsgiving. Miss Betty's Harvest Madsgiving, a Thanksgiving event in which Cook partners with local farmers, chefs, food distributors, volunteers, and organizations, helping the needy to cook and to hand out thousands of Thanksgiving meals across the Front Range. Volunteers with touching stories have reached out to Cook, offering their help on the holiday. We're talking about beautiful moms who are joining us this year in homage to their daughters who passed, Cook said. We're talking about individuals in their 20s who can't afford to go home, people in their 60s and 70s who just don't have any family and don't have anywhere else to go. I'm actually seeing this being impactful on both ends. Individuals who are in need and getting fed, and those who are volunteering to help. It's an emotional conversation. Cook, who said he comes from humble beginnings, often prepared food for people experiencing homelessness and gave it away while driving around Denver. For the past few Thanksgivings, Cook and his team have been doing the same on a bigger scale. The homemade meals would be passed out to Salvation Army locations, church groups, Volunteers of America, and people across the Front Range who could use some holiday spirit. On the menu, cranberry sauce, green beans, mashed potatoes, and gravy, roasted turkey, smoked pork, and chicken. When oven space at Zeppelin Station became tight, Nicholas Weber began working the grills outside the Denver Food Hall. The Zeppelin Station kitchen manager cooked up trays full of spatch-cocked birds and basked in the aroma of grilled meats. "It's great to be here feeding people," Weber said. "It's nice to see people doing and not just talking." Inside the restaurant space, benches that normally seat patrons were packed with trays full of food waiting to be packaged by bustling volunteers. Marissa Maselli and her 10-year-old son Rocco scooped potatoes into containers destined for hungry bellies across the Denver area. The Masellis saw a call for volunteers online and wanted to spend their Thanksgiving helping others. "We're so fortunate," Marissa Maselli said. "It's the least we can do. It's my responsibility to raise a gentleman." Rocco carried trays of food around the building, getting them ready to be packed up in trucks for local delivery. "There are people less fortunate than me, and I just want to help them," he said. And we have a few obituaries in today's paper, so I will read the basics from those. Mark Lee Chaffee of Berthoud, Colorado, born April 25, 1950, passed away suddenly on November 16, 2021. He is survived by his sister, Diane Chaffee, his brother, Brian Chaffee, his nephew, Coulter Chaffee, and his niece, Carmen Chaffee. He is predeceased by his parents, Harold and Lucille Chaffee. The family encourages people to share stories, quotes, memories, and images on the website at dignitymemorial.com, and a celebration of life is being planned for January. Gary Fritch, born April 2, 1954, and died November 10, 2021. He is survived by his children, James and Beth, siblings, and extended family. You can contact jfritch3223@gmail.com regarding possible services. Shirley Mae Johnson, born May 17, 1944, and died November 13, 2021, at age 77. She is survived by her two daughters, Cammy and Chris, and son Tim, 8 grandkids and 5 great-grandkids. She was predeceased by her husband, Marvin, and son, Brian. Services will be held at Littleton Bible Chapel on Datura Street in Littleton on Saturday, December 11th, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Nicholas Martin, 74, passed away on October 29th, 2021. He was born in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, to parents Roland and Betty Martin. He was preceded in death by his parents and brother Luke. Nick is survived by his wife, Joanne Cranwell Martin, and his son, Blair Martin, and grandson, Allie Martin, and stepson, Michael Cranwell, and granddaughters, Vivi and Adeline Cranwell. Bonnie Lee Salter, born September 30th, 1939, died November 4th, 2021. Funeral Mass will be at 10 a.m. on November 29th at Holy Family Catholic Church on Utica in Denver, Colorado. Burial will be at 2 p.m. at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Wheat Ridge. G. Anthony Uthis, born December 10, 1942, and died November 12, 2021. Tony Uthis is survived by his wife, Mary Ann Zarlingo Uthis, daughter Daniel Uthis, nephews John Uthis, Mark, Dave, and Eric Zarlingo, and nieces Lynn Treffren, Christy, and Susan Uthis. Military honors begin at 2:45 p.m. on November 29th at Fort Logan National Cemetery, followed by Mass at J.K. Mullen High School's De La Salle Chapel. For more information, visit HoranCares.com. Vernon James Purdy, born June 26, 1938, and died November 14, 2021, at age 83. Vern is survived by his sister, Marion McAllister, of Clarence, New York, his two children, Linda Michelle Purdy of Inglewood, Colorado, and William James Purdy of Denver, and their mother, Suzanne Duque Purdy of Inglewood. He's also survived by two grandchildren, Sophia and Logan Purdy of Denver. A memorial reception will be held at the Waterford Condominiums on Girard Place in Inglewood on January 7th at 5:30 p.m. Relatives and friends are welcome to share their memories of Vern. His ashes will be buried at Woodlawn Cemetery in New York. In lieu of flowers, please consider a memorial contribution in Vern's honor at the website for the Alzheimer's Association. Turning back to news, second teen arrested in drive-by shooting by Karen Nicholson. Aurora police have arrested a second suspect, another 15-year-old, connected to the midday drive-by shooting of six teenagers in a park across the street from Aurora Central High School. The second suspect was arrested after being questioned Tuesday night, police said in a Wednesday night news release. The second suspect was described as another occupant of the Chrysler 300. The shooting happened on November 15th in Nome Park, East 12th Avenue and Nome Street, police said. The first 15-year-old suspect was arrested Monday night and has been charged with attempted first-degree murder. Two vehicles believed to be involved in the shooting, a Chevrolet Tahoe and Chrysler 300, have been found and seized as part of the ongoing investigation. The first suspect arrested was described by police as the driver of the Chrysler. Their names have not been released because they are juveniles. The second suspect arrested is a student at Aurora Central. He, too, has been charged with attempted first-degree murder, police said. The day of the shooting, five of the teens, three boys and two girls between ages 14 and 17, were transported by ambulance to area hospitals. An 18-year-old also drove himself to the hospital with minor injuries, police said. One victim underwent emergency surgery. Police said gunfire from the park was directed at the two vehicles. Investigators are still attempting to identify the individuals who were inside of Nome Park shooting back at the Chevrolet Tahoe and the Chrysler 300, Wednesday's news release said. Anyone with information on the shooting who has not already talked to police is asked to call Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. Aurora shooting, students and school staff grapple with growing crisis by Melanie Asmar of Chalkbeat, Colorado. When classes resume Monday in Aurora Public Schools, psychologist Brittany Greert won't be at the elementary and middle school where she normally works. Instead, she will be at Hinckley High School, where three teens were shot and injured in the parking lot this month. She and the rest of the district's crisis response team will check in on the injured students' close friends, relatives, and teachers. Counselors will be available to meet with any student who wants to talk, and they will provide talking points to teachers who want to discuss the incident in class. Greert did something similar last week at Aurora Central High School after six students were wounded in a drive-by shooting at a nearby park. At Central, Greert's job was to support the teachers who witnessed the shooting, sometimes with an act as simple as offering to watch their classes for a few minutes so they could take a break. Unfortunately, this year all of our crisis teams have been very busy, Greert said. The shootings have caused additional strain in a school community that, as others have across the country, been navigating a tumultuous period defined by the pandemic and activism around social justice issues. School districts in cities such as Chicago, Philadelphia, and Memphis have grappled with how to respond to youth gun violence. In Aurora, the police chief and other city leaders have called the recent violence a public health crisis. The Denver Post reported that seven teens were shot in Aurora in the 3 weeks before the shooting near Aurora Central. Three of them died from their injuries. Aurora Public Schools Superintendent Rico Munn said he wants to understand the reasons for the rise in violent crime. We need to identify what are the threads that tie those things together that we can really attack to try to address what is a growing crisis in our community. Though school is out for the holiday week, Munn said he spoke Monday with the mayor and police chief, as well as leaders from the local NAACP and faith-based community groups. I was just reaching out, trying to hear about other people's thoughts on what's happening in the community, Munn said. We want to make sure we, as a community, identify ways to make every part of the community a safe haven for our students. In addition to offering extra mental health support, the district temporarily switched to a closed campus at Aurora Central last week, meaning students were not allowed outside during lunch. Munn said the district is exploring keeping safety issues such as that one in place until winter break. Lolita Angelcheva, a student at Aurora's Rangeview High School, has been raising funds for the shooting victims. She heard about the Hinckley shooting Friday when a friend got a phone notification during their criminal justice class. The teacher stopped the lesson and pivoted to talking about the recent violence involving Aurora students. The violence feels like it's escalating, Angelcheva said. In past years, it was a threat or kids getting into fights and a gun being pulled, she said. It's definitely bolder this year. Although bringing additional psychologists and counselors into affected schools may be helpful to some students, she said she has never taken advantage of it. When her school went on lockdown 3 years ago because a student brought what turned out to be a BB gun to school, she said she chose instead to talk to teachers she already knew. Instead of responding after tragedies, Angelcheva said the district needs to invest in hiring mental health workers who can relate to students before an incident happens. In a district as diverse as Aurora, those counselors need to be people of color, she said. Michelin Johnson, the executive director and founder of an organization called Rise 5280 that takes African American students to tour historically black colleges and universities, said her group has seen greater success connecting high school students with youth mentors, including young people who experienced violence but were eventually able to escape it. Most of the time, students want a space to just talk, Johnson said, but she said teenagers tell her they're scared to talk to teachers and they're unlikely to go to a local church or mental health center for help. They typically go to friends, she said. Grayert, the school psychologist, said she understands the hesitancy. After a traumatic event, not everybody might need to talk to a counselor, she said. Some kids might want to reach out to close people in their lives. We're available, but it's not helpful for us to push those conversations on kids who don't want to have them. Sometimes that might look like us supporting other staff members in the building who have those connections. Munn said he wants students to know the district is doing everything possible to help keep them safe. I want them to know, as we've said, when they come to school, they are surrounded by adults who love and care for them, Munn said. But Angelcheva said she worries the adults aren't going to take the bold action that's needed. My biggest fears were going to come back from Thanksgiving break and nothing is going to change, she said. Boulder High Senior to present Mars Balloon Research by Amy Bounds of the Daily Camera. Boulder High School senior Bryce Irving developed an interest in space exploration while living in Florida when he was younger, riding his scooter to watch SpaceX launches and visiting the Kennedy Space Center. In high school, he heard a presentation from a Ball aerospace engineer, contacted the engineer to learn more about his work, and found out about a Colorado Space Business Roundtable internship. He applied and was accepted to the week-long summer program, learning from employees at companies that included Lockheed Martin, Ball Aerospace, and Sierra Space. I have always been inspired by space, and seeing the work that the different engineers did seemed fun and inspired me even more to become an aerospace engineer, he said. He went on to apply for the Colorado Space Business Roundtable's Student Ambassador Program because he wanted to continue learning more about the Colorado space industry and make more connections. He's one of seven ambassadors this year. As an ambassador, he researched the use of balloons to navigate the Martian terrain. He plans to present his Mars balloon research to space industry professionals at the annual Colorado Space Business Roundtable Roundup Wednesday at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. For his research, he looked at whether a balloon could maintain lift on Mars. He created an equation to take into account the different factors that could affect the balloon, including temperature, atmospheric pressure and density, altitude, the balloon material, and the mass of the balloon's payload. Then he created a Python program using that equation so he could test the effects of changing variables on the radius, tensile strength, and altitude of the balloon. He learned Python and other programming languages as part of the Boulder High Robotics team, and he is now the team captain. Robotics has also given me a lot of practice in designing solutions to problems and collaborating with others to find solutions, he said. He found that as the altitude of the balloon increases, the radius of the balloon increases exponentially. Also, the heavier the material of the balloon, the more volume it needs to have a large enough buoyant force for lift. He said he still wants to investigate the effects of the sun heating the balloon in the day and cooling it at night, as well as account for gases diffusing through the thin plastic of the balloon. He's planning to major in aerospace and mechanical engineering in college and is interested in aerodynamics, astrodynamics, structures, and systems engineering. I also want to build rockets, so I think that aerospace engineering will allow me to learn some of the skills I might need after college, he said. Hiker finds remains of fourth and final victim of July flood by the Associated Press, Dateline Fort Collins. A hiker found the remains of the fourth and final person who died during flooding and mudslides in an area of northern Colorado that was burned by a massive wildfire, authorities said. The remains of Diana Brown, 57, of San Antonio, were found Saturday, according to the Larimer County Sheriff's Office. She was swept away by the flood waters July 20th, along with her family members, Richard Brown of Bellevue, Nebraska, Patricia Brown of Madison, Wisconsin, and David Brown, also from San Antonio. Richard Brown owned a mobile home in the area, but his home residence was in Bellevue, the Fort Collins Coloradoan reported. All four victims were in the same house in the small Black Hollow area, 45 miles west of Fort Collins, when the flood hit. The first three bodies were recovered several days after the flood, and the search was suspended July 29th with no sign of Diana Brown's body. Another unsuccessful search involving 120 people took place in mid-September. The flooding and slides happened in an area that was burned last year by the 326-square-mile Cameron Peak Fire, the largest in Colorado's history. Fires torch vegetation that usually helps absorb rain and keep the ground stable, making those areas more vulnerable to flooding, especially in steep sections. The soil in burned areas also can repel rain. Six homes were destroyed and one other was damaged, all on the same road, according to the sheriff's office. Scientists say climate change is responsible for more intense and frequent extreme weather, like flooding and droughts and events like wildfires, but more research is needed to determine how much global warming is to blame, if at all, for a single event. And in international news, Swedish Prime Minister lasts about 7 hours. It seemed like a new era was dawning in Sweden on Wednesday when Magdalena Andersson, leader of the center-left Social Democratic Party, became the country's first female prime minister. Her historic term lasted about 7 hours. She resigned Thursday, a day after a painful budget defeat in parliament. She had only just formed a two-party minority government with the Green Party, but after their budget was rejected in favor of one proposed by the opposition, which included the far-right Sweden Democrats Party, the Green Party quit the coalition out of frustration. That left Andersson without a partner. Her resignation plunged Sweden into political uncertainty. The country's political landscape has been frayed by fragile coalition governments and a vote of no confidence in June against the former prime minister, Stefan Löfven. Anderson succeeded Löfven as leader of the Social Democrats. Sweden at one point accepted more refugees per capita than any other European nation. The political spectrum has shifted to the right with increasing anti-immigrant and anti-European voices. Anderson, 54, announced that she was the new prime minister in a Facebook statement a little before 10 a.m. local time on Wednesday. A little after 4:30 p.m. the same day, she released a second Facebook statement announcing her resignation. Until a new government is elected, the current one will remain on. Anderson has said she is still ready to serve as prime minister, but only in a one-party government. Thank you for joining us for the Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy.
Students with disabilities in Douglas County won some time after a federal judge ruled last week that a new health order making mask wearing optional in school would put students at risk of irreparable harm. But with a new conservative-leaning school board set to take over at the end of the month, that reprieve could be short-lived. David Monroe with Disability Law Colorado says if the new board decides to embrace the health order, students and families would be back at square one.
What's at stake here is the right for especially students with disabilities to have a right to get the same public education every other child does, but to get that education in an atmosphere which is safe to them, does not compromise or jeopardize their health.
Families of students with disabilities and the Douglas County School District took the county's new health department to court, arguing that making masks optional was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered the health department to stop enforcement of the order for 14 days. County health officials disagreed with the judge's decision and claimed the order strikes the right balance between public health and parental choice. Children with disabilities frequently face serious health challenges, and Monroe says many parents pulled their kids out of school during COVID surges, uncertain if mask mandates were being followed. But when kids aren't in school, Monroe says they're losing out on their right to an appropriate public education.
They're children who have had health issues that may leave them immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. They can be at a much higher risk of having a very serious health outcome if they get COVID.
Douglas County School District's president welcomed the court's temporary restraining order and said in a statement that no one should have to choose between sending their children to school and putting their health at risk. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're going to make transformational changes that are going to lift the people of America to a new sense, born of optimism.
House Ways and Means Chairman Richard Neal spoke in favor of the Build Back Better Act in a session that went deep into the night on Capitol Hill. The $1.7 trillion social spending and climate bill includes provisions for universal pre-K, paid leave, reduced child care costs, drug pricing negotiations, and invest billions of dollars into fighting climate change. Democrat Veronica Escobar of Texas hailed provisions that would help process immigration benefits and protect millions from deportation.
While this is not everything that we have wanted, God, let me tell you, I will take it and run with it.
Prior to the vote, Republican Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy spoke at length, arguing the package will raise energy costs and increase taxes.
Through no fault of their own, good, hardworking Americans are being hurt by their own government. And Mr. Speaker, that's just wrong.
And Congressman Jim Jordan noted inflation is already at a 31-year high.
Thanksgiving turkey is going to cost more. Christmas presents for your family are going to cost more in Joe Biden's America. This bill is so bad.
The Congressional Budget Office predicted the bill will add $367 billion to the deficit over a decade. The CBO projects its enhanced IRS tax enforcement would yield $120 billion over 10 years. The White House says it would bring in $400 billion. More than 230 Republicans from both chambers of Congress are behind a new effort to prevent the Biden administration's vaccine requirement for private businesses with over 100 employees.
Our Congressional Review Act resolution would nullify this overreach by the White House. More importantly, it puts every member of Congress on record. You're either with this type of authoritarian rule or you're against it.
That's Congressman Fred Keller of Pennsylvania. The mandate was temporarily halted by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, but more than 60 health groups are encouraging companies to voluntarily implement the mandate. President Joe Biden hosted his first trilateral meeting with Canada and Mexico's leaders. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau noted their shared goals.
Our highest priority is, of course, ending COVID-19 and being focused on economic recovery, strengthened supply chains.
Canada and Mexico voiced concerns the Build Back Better plan's tax credit would benefit American car manufacturing. The Biden administration rescinded waivers that allowed child welfare agencies in Michigan, South Carolina, and Texas to bypass federal non-discrimination rules if they conflict with the provider's religious beliefs. Civil rights groups argue the Trump-era rules allowed for discrimination. And finally, one day after Congressman Paul Gosar was censured for posting a violent video that depicted him killing Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Gosar retweeted the same video, and former President Donald Trump endorsed the Arizona Republican for re-election. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Did you know AINC offers time and weather services on our regular phone menu? Just call 303-786-7777 extension 5 for your local time and weather report. No internet needed.